AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 57 for Thursday, May 27th, 2010. Magnetic Railguns. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Here we are Thursday night once again, and as I keep on saying every week, man, do we have a lot to talk about. And joining me, as always, here to talk about it is the auto extremist, Mr. De Lorenzo.
John, it's another amazing week in the wacky world of automobile.
Is it ever? And the man with the facts at his fingertips, David Welch from Bloomberg. See, I'm adding that, Bloomberg Business Week.
That's right. Great to be here as always, John.
Great. And as you guys know, we had big breaking news this afternoon with and Bloomberg breaking the news
right
at that,
Norton,
of Ford ostensibly looking at finally winding down the Mercury brand, something that we talked about here last week, as a matter of fact.
I remember writing a story about the possible death of Mercury when I was covering Ford for the Detroit News in like 98. But they're basically going to bleed it out. You know, they've got some products that are going to that they still have, but they're going to go away at the end of the life cycle, and they'll just phase it out. And they're going to bring a plan to the board on how they're going to do that, deal with the dealers and everything else. It's at the June or the July board meeting. I forget now. But, I was reading the story just before Keith took off and I came out here. So
Keith being Keith Knott, who broke the story.
And Ford hasn't really fought us on it at all, so it's going away, and it should, really. What does Mercury really do?
Well, my attitude on it is they have to rejuvenate and jumpstart Lincoln. You know, Lincoln is not as bad as Cadillac was when GM decided to rebuild Cadillac. I mean, that was disaster. Lincoln's, you know, pretty good, but I think this is a signal that they're going to go all in on Lincoln and really try to make it not just, you know, being there, but to make it ultra competitive, and it should be interesting.
I think it'll be more than interesting. You know, one thing that Ford's getting really good at right now is in-car electronics, especially from an infotainment standpoint. Sync and now this My Ford Touch or My Lincoln Touch is more than a generation ahead of everybody right now,
yeah,
which is really significant to be that far out in front for as long as they've been.
I don't think the viewers out there realize how just advanced this system is that Ford's coming out with. It's just unbelievable.
It is. And when you look at how they're already allowing software developers to develop apps for this My Ford Touch, nobody else in the business is doing that, at least not yet. And what I'm getting at is, as in-car electronics from an infotainment, information, entertainment, navigation, yada-da-da standpoint becomes more and more and more important.
It does, but you know what? People don't buy BMWs because of iDrive, and they don't buy a Mercedes because of the command system.
Yeah, but this is different. It really is different.
Look, it's great. I'm not going to undercut how good their system is.
No, in fact,
but
people
Lincoln
don't buy BMWs because of the iDrive.
True.
But I think if you make a really easy-to-use interface and it brings in stuff that people really like in a car, that this may shift the whole playing field in terms of everyone's – I'm not saying starting from scratch, but I think Lincoln via Ford has a way of – maybe jumping into the luxury segment as an important brand faster than just trying to build up the basic bones of the cars themselves.
But I think they've got a problem with the basic bones of the cars. Because
I agree.
I don't think luxury buyers want front drive unless it's all-wheel drive. And you've seen what Audi has done. You know, they've done a lot in terms of, and we've talked about this, in terms of engineering to get rear-wheel drive proportions, because that's what people like in luxury cars. They like the short front overhangs and the long hood and the greenhouse cocked back, and that's sort of your classic luxury car look, and people like it, and BMW does it masterfully. It's one of the secrets of their brand. And Lincoln just isn't there. Cadillac has that. And Cadillac also sells in China, and they've had a lot of stops and starts in Europe. If they actually put some money behind it, they might be able to do something there. But Cadillac has a better story as far as trying to become a global luxury brand. I mean, they're both nowhere with that right now, really, other than Cadillac being in China. But I just think Lincoln's got a long way to go in terms of really doing something. Now, they're going to focus on the brand better now that Mercury is gone. And, you know, hopefully for the dealer's sake, they'll give some of those models to Lincoln instead of wasting time with it.
Yeah, well, after Pontiac was killed off, I'm numb to this now. That hurt. So Mercury, I know why they're doing it. I agree with why they're doing it. And they've got to make Lincoln, you know, be a long-term player. And
it's not a big boost for Lincoln either. I mean, Mercury really hasn't gotten much. Yeah. It's just rebadged Fords.
I don't know anybody personally, though, who's mourning Mercury going away.
I don't even know anyone who drives a Mercury. I really don't. I'm not being flippant here. I don't know anyone who owns a Mercury.
Yeah, it's like you say, it's been rebadged Fords, and this is, I think it's good news for Ford all the way around. I think it's very good news for Lincoln, but I got to believe the Lincoln Mercury dealers are very nervous about this because, yeah, we all talk about where Lincoln can go, but it's not there yet, and they've needed this volume that Mercury gets.
Does it really
them.
Give them that much volume, though?
Since well, as dealers,
down like 80% over the past, whatever Keith had in the story, it's past 4 or 5 years, I think.
Yeah, I should look it up.
Not much there. Yeah, if you can.
No, what their total sales were last year, for example.
Lincoln was, it was almost like an appendix that was just never taken out. I mean, they came up with it during the Depression as sort of a mid-level brand, or almost entry luxury, in the same way that LaSalle was for Cadillac. And when GM didn't need LaSalle anymore, they got rid of it. And Mercury just hung around for a long time. And they were always rebadged Fords. Mercury Monarchs were the same thing as Ford Granadas. And you know, it's been that way for a very long time. There's been no unique proposition for this brand except for the Mercury Capri in a very long time.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's exactly right. And that's where they could have done it well years ago, is just bring in the Ford of Europe stuff and call them Mercuries. And, in fact, Lutz tried that when he was at Ford. If you remember, the whole Mercure line was going to be right. European products. But then they brought in, what was it, the Granada? It was here called the XR4 Ti.
I remember the XR4 Ti.
But, I mean, you know, most...
That's a great...
Most...
What's her name? Nina when we need her.
Yeah, XR, right.
What right. Psychographically, psychologically does XR4 Ti say?
You know,
say?
You go into some car designer shops, and or like Mitchell, didn't he have like a Blue Marlin or no, he had a sure. Mako Shark. And others would have like Blue Marlins. And so, whoever the designer was on that Ford Granada must have had a big carp in his office, you know, a catfish with all the whiskers coming off the bottom. That was an ugly car. It was kind of cool because it was different, but it wasn't a beautiful machine.
I think whoever did the XR4 Ti had a poster of C-3PO in his office.
And then, let me find these sales numbers if I can.
I love that name.
Which name?
XR4 Ti.
Yeah. Well, you know, most people don't know that, but that was Lutz's baby, down to the name, Mercure, which everybody here called Merker until they were corrected. But
they didn't talk about that at Bob's going away party. Sorry, Bob.
Way to go, Dave. Killed it.
He's not coming on the show now.
No, I think he will. But we'll contact him later. So, Peter, in your column this week, you were talking about the oil spill.
First of all, let me just say to the mentally challenged out there that nowhere in that column did I say that oil was going away anytime soon or that we were going to snap our fingers and have alternative fuels just coming out of our... I mean, sometimes I really don't understand what people read when they read because I get emails from... I have to actually go back and read my column to see what did you actually read or what did you take away? Okay, so anyway, get that over with. But
that's a job hazard.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, after 11.
But it happens. Yeah,
it happens all the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point was, I believe that this disaster in the Gulf will be the tipping point for the collective American consciousness.
Really? I mean, look, I read your column, and I think it's very possible. But we've also seen a lot of things that were supposed to be the tipping point.
Well, I understand.
The first person Gulf War, the 9/11, the fuel price spike from a couple summers ago, and then like 4 months later we get collective amnesia.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to be a collective amnesia when this stuff is going to be playing out in the Gulf for a decade or more, and that it's going to decimate an entire region financially, economically.
Right.
But beyond that, I think people really believe, I mean, what's that place, Cascada?
Cascada, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have to believe that we are going to see major advancements come to fruition. And I think the American consumer is going to be much more willing to embrace it. I think technological development is going to accelerate, and I think we will get there. We have to want to get there.
Right.
Compromises will have to be made, too, to do it, because
we're not going to be.
We'll either be drilling for more natural gas, and we have a fair amount of it.
We're going to be drilling for oil for a long time to come.
Right.
But to really start getting away from it, we may have to really push electric cars or cars like the Volt, and we'll need to generate more electricity somewhere, which invariably means nuclear. They do it in France. There are plans for a lot of nuclear power plants in China. But not here in America. People don't want it. I'm not making an editorial comment on whether they're good or bad, because disposing of that waste is a real issue. But if we want to get away from oil, we've talked about this.
The transition will be painful. But am I advocating we all drive around in pea shooter, two-cylinder, shiny, happy, smiley Flintstone cars? No. I want V8s and lots of horsepower, but we can burn other fuel to still have what we like to do. I just think we need to get on it.
No, I agree with you. I think we could be at a tipping point. Now, supposedly they're capping the well today as we speak. And if they're able to cut that off, great. And if, you know, there's still a disaster to deal with. But if this capping of the well thing doesn't work, and this goes on for months to come, I mean, I heard two guys, NPR did this big deep dive analysis, and they're talking about using bunker bombs, and if that doesn't work, maybe a nuke down there to shut it off for good. Very serious discussion about this. So, I mean, if it goes to that point, I think we are definitely at the tipping point, and that people will embrace alternatives. But they just got to get it through their head that the reason we use oil, so much of it, is it's just so damn cheap. There's so much of it, and it's so damn cheap. All the alternatives cost more money than it does. So you've got to be willing to accept the fact that you're going to pay more at the pump for whatever comes along, or charging, or if it's natural gas or whatever it happens to be. But it's going to cost you more. It's not going to cost you less.
And we have to, again, I've said this repeatedly, we have to get into this America Inc. thing. And we need to reward technological development and innovation and encourage it and make it as financially easy as possible.
Instead of trying to use stuff like CAFE to usher it in with the rod.
Exactly.
Right. Well, in fact, Sheila Ronis will be joining us later and talking about, from a military standpoint, why exactly what you're saying is necessary from a national security standpoint, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how, you know, a lot of the technology to do all this, both militarily and in the auto industry, is right here in town.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, are we going to be drilling for oil? Sure. Are we going to be using oil? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who's kidding who? You know, there's probably an overreaction now. Oh, we're going to stop drilling now. Reality is oil's going to be.
I think we will have continued and maybe even tighter restrictions on where we can drill. The drill baby drill crowd wants to see Alaska and offshore, off the Atlantic seaboard and elsewhere in the Gulf that have been some places that have been shut down, reopened, and that's just off the table for
now. You bet.
And John, your favorite is the algae thing.
Well, right.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Well, you know, and algae, all I'll say is it looks mighty promising. It's not there yet. It's got to be it's yet to be proved that it can be scaled up on an industrial scale.
Well, a lot of things aren't there yet.
Right. But when you look at what it potentially could deliver, it's good. And I keep saying whether it's algae or cellulosic ethanol, it's all bioengineered, really. And that happens to be something that this country is really, really good at. It plays to our strengths. And that's what a lot of the ethanol critics have missed, is that the producers, the refiners, and everybody working on it haven't been sitting on their hands. We're far better now than we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, especially 20 or 30 years ago, when a lot of studies said, oh, ethanol makes no sense at all. A lot's changing and continues to change.
Well, if Cascada can do that, if they can really make ethanol out of garbage, which...
Then America's number one! I've always said if we can make fuel out of garbage, we'll dominate the world.
They say they can. Now, can they scale it up and all of that? That's the big question.
Wasn't that what the DeLorean was powered with in Pact of the Future?
Nuclear fusion.
Does GM still own a stake of Cascada?
Good question. It's probably more likely that Liquidation Motors owns it.
Who knows?
That was only announced 3 years ago.
But did it survive through the bankruptcy and all that?
I don't know. Two and a half years ago in Detroit.
I don't know where Cascada is. I know they are producing. I don't know on what scale.
We should get someone from Cascada on here.
That's a good one. In fact, I know a really good guy who knows ethanol in all aspects, so not just argue one company side of it. But ethanol production in this country is skyrocketing. People don't realize we have blown through all the mandates that Congress set down by billions of gallons. We'll probably produce some 13 billion gallons of ethanol this year. We're producing so much ethanol right now, believe it or not, we're actually exporting it to Brazil. That's how much ethanol we're producing. And if you look around town here, it's mainly in the Midwest, you know, you can't use the major pipelines to ship it. So you got to be close to where they make it for it to really make sense.
Why can't they use the major pipelines?
Because ethanol is alcohol, absorbs too much water. For E85, now all gasoline in the United States today virtually is E10.
Right.
So, and you can take it up to, I don't know, you can probably double what it is right now, E20, say, and still ship it through pipelines. But once you get into the E85 range, it's the refiners just, the pipeline guys won't let you do it. But the point of the matter is you can buy ethanol just a few miles from here right now for 50 cents a gallon cheaper than regular gasoline. So the math is there. Yeah, you lose mileage by going with ethanol, fuel economy, because it's not as energy dense. But if you drop the price by that percentage amount, it's a wash. You still, economically, it makes sense. And in places like Iowa, Nebraska, and other places, it's a buck a gallon cheaper for E85. Where they have all kinds of ethanol readily available. So I don't want to just say ethanol is the answer. It's not. It's one of the solutions. And it's really, if you look at it, it's the biggest alternative we have right now, by far. Nothing else comes close in trying to match it. Speaking of alternatives, Carlos Ghosn was in town this week. Singing the praises of electric cars.
Talking about all in.
he's like the hero in opera, all, you know, singing the praises of EVs. What do you guys make of him saying he's going to sell 500,000 EVs in, what, 4 years' time?
Yeah, that electric vehicles will be 10% of the global market.
No, 1%.
1%, yeah.
Actually, 0.8 to 0.9%
is
what he sees.
1%.
I'm only looking for 0.8 or 0.9% of the global market, which is, I know what he's saying, but it's the kind of statistic where, okay, it's a total non-starter in emerging markets because the cars, these are markets like India where people are buying 3,500-hour nanos. So, out. China is, you know, they're not there yet in terms of, you know, buying that many expensive cars. It's getting there, but they don't have the charging stations and all that kind of capability. That is where the most potential is, though, is the U.S. and Chinese markets. But in China, BYD is there. And Warren Buffett's got a stake of that, and they've
Well, the
got
difference in China, if the government says we're going to have charging stations all the way down this road...
It'll be there next
it'll
week.
It'll be there, but he's going to have competition. But he does have some real potential there. In the U.S., I still think it's going to be a tough slog for electric cars because of the charging stations, drain on the electric infrastructure, and just the biggest thing, consumer acceptability.
Oh, well, there'll be pockets of electrification.
Well, see, this is what I think.
Portland, but you have to have it in Portland and you have to have it in Peoria, and you know, to really get the kind of numbers he's talking about in the U.S. anyway.
I can just see it now, Northern California. You'll be able to recharge your electric vehicle and get a hug on your way out of the station.
I will say it's not as crazy as it sounds when you consider that the 500,000 that they want to produce are for 8 different vehicles for Renault and Nissan in a bunch of different markets.
Yeah, well, when you sit with Simon and he lays it out, it's plausible. Mm-hmm. 0 to 500,000 vehicles in 4 years.
It's not as insane as it sounds when he just gets up on the podium and says 500,000 cars, because he doesn't really explain all of that very clearly.
And when it's
I still don't think he's going to get there.
I don't either, but...
Well, you know, if he was the only game in the world, I'd say, yeah, you might get there. But look at everybody who's pouring in at the same time. How many volts are going to be siphoned off from those sales? And Fisker and Tesla and mm-hmm. Bright and all these others.
He doesn't consider the volt to be competition, and I think he's wrong about that.
Well, if he doesn't count it as competition, he might be able to claim higher market share for himself. But
he's not going to measure that. We are. So,
right.
Strike two.
He doesn't count because it has an onboard.
Right. That doesn't matter. That was like the debate over, you know, mild hybrid versus strong hybrid and all that. Consumers just want a proposition that's clean, green, gets great mileage, and fits their need. And I think they're going to look at a plug-in Prius, a Volt, a Tesla, a Leaf, and on down the line and make their decision. Some people will want an all-electric vehicle, and Nissan will have a leg up there, but you're still looking at the green buyer.
Another development we saw this week is Ford announcing its... of course, they've already announced all this stuff, but now they're actually showing it at the plants where they're going to build batteries themselves and build the transaxles for strong hybrids themselves, pulling work out of Mexico and Japan
and bringing it here
to Michigan. But what I find interesting is, you know, we've seen 30 years of automakers outsourcing. And, I mean, they've literally gone, companies like Ford and GM, from making in-house 70 to 80% of the parts in the car to just the opposite. You know, some 70% plus of a car today is purchased. So I find it very interesting that Ford's vertically integrating, putting all the capability in-house to do everything for EVs. And strategically, very interesting move. They obviously really want to be able to control the cost.
I think it's a great move on their part. I think it's a very confident move on their part, you know, and they're looking down the road. And well, like you pointed out on the radio today, you know, back when Henry started the company, he wanted all of that under his direct control. And for a while, it worked great.
It worked great. Hey, as long as they could have any color they wanted, as long as it was black, that was an easy model to follow.
Yeah.
You know, if you're just doing the same thing year in, year out, day in, day out, hour in, hour out, it's easy to control everything, run it like a Swiss watch.
But I think Ford's doing the smart thing because, you know, this is going to be their thing, their technology. They're going to make her live or die with their own stuff. I think it's a good way to go.
Yeah. Well, hey, this is probably a good point to bring Sheila Ranis on the show. Sheila, come on up here and have a seat. And you'll have to put your own microphone on there. Oh, no, Chip's going to come help you do that. So, Sheila, I don't know how to identify you exactly. I mean, you're kind of like a professor, a philosopher. The reason I wanted you on the show is because you have such deep roots into the national security system in the U.S., so many ties into the military. I should mention to people that some years back, Sheila brought me to the National Defense University. And when you see Sheila, she doesn't conjure up the image of war fighter. She's this soft, cuddly, very nice, warm person. And I go to the National Defense University, and here's two-star and three-star generals falling all over themselves to try and, you know, welcome Sheila back to the place that I was really impressed. But welcome to Autoline After Hours.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Hey, one of the things I wanted to start out talking to you about actually goes back to the bankruptcies last year of General Motors and Chrysler. Mm-hmm. When I was shocked to see nationwide this whole attitude of who needs them, let them go down the tubes. We don't. Who cares if Ford goes down? Who cares if we lose all these suppliers and the like? And I got to imagine your contacts in the defense industry were pulling their hair out over this.
Actually, they were, John. It's kind of funny because many years ago, as you may remember, when I was doing a lot of work with GM. And I was worried about, you know, what would happen if they failed. I once mentioned to a very senior person at General Motors that if they really mess up the company too badly, that the United States government will come in and nationalize you. And they just laughed because they thought I was crazy. And of course, I was already beginning to work with the U.S. Army by then, and I was working with the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and they were watching the erosion of the U.S. industrial base. And unlike the folks in automotive who don't understand that at the bottom of the base, you know, all the industries share suppliers, and the Department of Defense understands those supply chain issues a whole lot better than the car companies do.
So wait, are you suggesting here that one of the reasons why the U.S. government stepped in and essentially created government motors out of General Motors was because of national defense issues?
Oh, absolutely. I think that played a very large role behind the scenes. I don't think it was publicly discussed a lot, but I know what a lot of the discussion was behind the scenes, and in fact, there were a lot of folks at the Pentagon saying that they were very worried.
And explain why, because I don't think people, when you talk like supply chain and all that, talk a little bit more about the cross-link between why the auto industry, even though it doesn't make tanks or planes or ships or anything like that anymore, why it's still important to the national defense base.
Well, I think, John, part of the issue is that when you have a little tool and die shop out in Warren, Michigan, you know, and 85% of their business is tied to General Motors and Ford, what people don't understand is that 15% of their business may be tied to building a specific weapon system for the Tank Automotive and Armaments Command, or for the folks at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So when General Motors and Ford collapse and take all of the little guys with them, like the little tool and die shop or mom-and-pop shop that's in Warren, that 15% that they are doing for the Department of Defense disappears, and some major weapon system may be out a major component of some kind. Those are the kinds of linkages that you don't understand unless you really see all the way down to dirt, as DOD would say, and they're beginning to take very seriously this issue, not only because of the tool and die shops in Warren, Michigan, but because of the components that end up in third and fourth and fifth tier subsystem makers that are coming from China. And obviously, it's probably not a good idea for our weapon systems to have Chinese components in them, especially since we can't verify that they're real or bogus.
Yeah. There seems to be more of an interest now of getting the auto industry re-engaged with the military. I know here in town, the Tank Automotive Command, TACOM as it's known, or TARDEC, and I can't remember what all that's research and engineering stuff.
Right.
But it seems to me like the military is reaching out more now to the auto industry than I've seen in my entire career.
Well, it isn't only the Tank Automotive and Armaments Command. It's also the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is the major acquisition site for the U.S. Air Force. So right here in Michigan and Ohio, we have the two major acquisition chains for the entire U.S. Army and the entire U.S. Air Force. And they're there for a reason. They're there because the knowledge of design, engineering, fundamentally manufacturing of all kinds of components and systems and electronics. And, you know, the most sophisticated leading-edge stuff was coming out of the automotive industry, even before it went into aerospace sometimes.
That's interesting. I don't think most people realize that kind of connection.
So is it more the supply chain that they were worried about than what the automakers themselves would bring to the military-industrial base?
No, I think it's both, David. I really do. I just don't see how... One of the big studies I did 5 years ago for Congress was looking at the national security implications of the erosion of the industrial base in its entirety. One of the things we found is you couldn't separate them. You just couldn't separate out the, the defense piece of it, because there was no way. How do you take the 15% out of the little tool and die shop? You know, you can't do it. And it isn't just tool and die shops. I mean, it's the software writers at Microsoft, and I mean, it's everybody. And there's no way to do that. So, if you really want to have a healthy supply chain for a weapon system, you've got to understand the other industries that the lower tier companies are also supporting.
Do the people you deal with in the Pentagon consider the arsenal of democracy sort of scenario again, where we're in some big conflict and we need to switch auto plants over? Is that something they still think about, or is that just a yesteryear way of mechanizing for the military?
I wish I could give you an easy answer to that. There are some people who think that that's a ludicrous idea. We live in a global economy, and we can find allies and friends and partners who will, in fact, help us, get there. The reality, though, is that a whole lot of other people know that, in fact, even some of our closest allies have political exigencies in their countries where sometimes they can't do what the senior government officials might even promise. And so there are lots of issues. There are people who are starting to rethink and reconsider are there elements of the U.S. economy that we better make sure are really strong? And what does strong mean? What does that mean? And I think for the first time I'm seeing that kind of thinking coming out of the folks at the Pentagon who are really beginning to believe we've got some serious grand strategy to do, and it has to do with not only our dependence on other countries, but who are they, what kinds of dependencies are there, and are there some that are really unhealthy?
Well, what we haven't even gotten into is the erosion of the skills, engineering and
piece of the puzzle. So when you do a grand strategy, you have to go all the way back to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education at the K-12 level, all the way to what our institutions of higher education are doing. And I don't think that the nation has had that kind of a grand strategy for many years.
Well, how much of that is because there's been an erosion of manufacturing going on in this country for a long time?
Right.
So while there were still many jobs to be had, it wasn't the growing hot place to go into, so the smart kids didn't go into engineering. They went into finance so they could get on the street and make millions of dollars creating derivatives and doing IPOs and flipping junk bonds and stuff like that. That's where the brilliant people go, or into healthcare and medicine, because that also is booming because the boomers are getting older and insurance companies pay for it all, and we have this big healthcare problem now, but it was all basically covered by some company's healthcare plan. So those are the two boom areas. That's where the brilliant people go, and a lot of people want to go there. And we don't have as many students going into engineering and science and that sort of thing because that's not that wasn't the hot place? Because am I making the right connection here? Because manufacturing was eroding, so it wasn't the cool, the big hot sector to go into?
I think it's a combination of many things. One, the jobs weren't there. As jobs started to erode, people found out that when they had engineering degrees, they couldn't find jobs. And I think that more than anything, it was the outsourcing, first of the lower end of the value-added chain. But as soon as you outsource the lower end, the higher value-added steps also started to erode. That process has been going on for decades. And so I think what you saw in the engineering schools was a situation where people couldn't guarantee the students jobs anymore. And you are absolutely spot on when it comes to making sure we have enough people in this country who have the knowledge in their heads in the event of a national emergency when we might have to reconstitute something. And I think for the first time there are folks in Washington taking the whole concept seriously. Just a couple years ago, I had the great honor of participating in a study for the National Academies, which was called Rising Above the Gathering Storm. And that's exactly the issue that they were looking at.
But, since I started in this business, and I'd say I think I first heard my first speech from an industry executive saying we're facing an engineering shortage in 1980. Yeah. So here it is 30 years later, and they're still saying, we're facing an engineering shortage. And I don't think it's happened, and for two reasons. Number one, to your point, there's all kinds of engineers in Asia. I mean, there's a lot of engineering talent out there. But even more importantly, and I think this has been the deciding thing, is computers have gotten so sophisticated. The software is so powerful that one engineer today can do what many more engineers were needed to have done in the past. You don't need acres and acres of drawing rooms anymore. You go into software development or even engineering development centers right now, and there'll be rooms with five or six workstations and people working and doing what would have taken bullpens and bullpens of people in the past to do.
I
think it's an issue, but I don't think it's as dire, and I only say that because I've been hearing the same story for 30 years.
Yeah, well, I understand. But what does worry me is there are areas within engineering where we truly are losing our, at one time we had a competitive advantage over other nations because we had more people with more expertise. And as those whole industries disappear from our shores, we're just going to have nobody left.
Battery is one of them.
That is correct.
But I'll tell you one thing, too. An issue in China right now is the massive amount of highly educated young college grads who cannot find the kind of work that they've been trained to do.
I absolutely
and so
agree.
They got a lot of engineers.
That's a huge social issue for
them. A social issue, but it's another one. At some point, they're going to realize, we're educating way too many engineers.
Yeah.
So I think it'll balance out. But I also think it's time that we ought to get to some of the questions from our viewers here. And Ben, let's bring up the graphic for rapid fire. Okay, we call it rapid fire because we try to answer rapidly and get to as many questions as possible. But George from Brooklyn wants to know, Sheila, what do you predict or anticipate for the auto industry over the next 5 years?
Actually, I think the global auto industry is going to boom. I don't see any other way that it won't. And I think General Motors and Ford are going to recover a lot. I'm not as positive about Chrysler.
Okay. 007, Mitch W. says, Peter, please explain what Formula needs to do in the U.S. to serve its automotive sponsors.
Formula One?
That's what it says here. Actually, George has sent in two questions. Maybe this is a better one. Why did Formula One go to Austin instead of New Jersey?
Because there is a consortium down there who has an in with Bernie Ecclestone and the financial resources and the wherewithal and the willingness to stay under the radar and work on this out of, you know, out of view of everyone. They've got almost 800 acres earmarked just east of Boston, and they're going to build, they've contracted the guy who's built these most recent Formula One palaces in Dubai and everything, who's going to do the track. I think it's a pipe dream. I'll believe it when I'm drinking margaritas sitting over the start-finish line when the Formula One cars come out for their first practice session. I wish them all the best, but it's intriguing as hell.
It's intriguing. I would just say, just look at the trash heap of Formula One venue history in the United States.
I mean, they've raped and pillaged this country and the promoters and the cities and the venues repeatedly. And, you know, they just want to say, okay, we're going to get a turnkey palace and it'll all be good. It's not so fast. And I think that other question was, what does Formula One need to do to sell itself here? At this point, I really don't know. It's just
Indy might get there first.
Yeah, I think Indy will get there first
because of the new formula.
I'm very optimistic of where Indy is going.
Would David please explain his fascination with soccer? Did he play the game or something?
I didn't play a lot of it. I got a buddy from Russia actually who got me into the game, and the really cool thing about watching, and actually I like to watch rugby too, because the action doesn't stop. You don't have these long committee meetings in between plays like you do in football.
Oh,
and
I've
been to your house watching football. I like to watch football, but
no, I know you do.
It's not like
David. David's the go-to guy on European stuff like that. I mean, he's got
that's cool
a reams of knowledge that just shock me.
Hey, here's one right up your alley. What does the situation with North Korea entail for South Korea and their auto industry, investment and capital?
I think that the South Koreans have a great deal to fear. I'm not sure right now if I were getting ready to invest in a South Korean company, I would, partly because I think I'd almost be afraid to go there. I think that there is real peril there for a variety of reasons. And the real issue is going to be, can the global diplomats defuse what is really an incendiary situation?
Yeah, because, you know, North Korea could want to just up and pop a nuclear cap in South Korea's butt before anyone could do anything about it.
Well, I think that there are some serious fears there.
And
I think they're well-founded,
yes,
unfortunately. You know, I
mean,
this is really scary.
It's a tender
box. Step up and
North Korea. Good question.
Well,
cut it out.
It's all about China until they wake up and realize that this could be bad for us, too.
Well, it could be bad for them.
Yeah.
Because I don't think China has ever really experienced what a flight of capital is going to look like. And all it's going to take is one nuclear device going off in the region, and
game over. It'll be like, okay, see ya.
That's it.
Okay, Jonathan Brown wants to know, what's your opinion, and I'll throw this to you, Peter, possibility of a dual-clutch sequential transmission for the C7 Corvette, and how much horsepower? 475 for the pace model?
I think you can almost assume that the C7 will have some sort of advanced double clutch, super duper sequential transmission as an option. Probably the preferred option. You'll still be able to get a manual, but it'll be much more like the 458 Italia Ferrari. And I mean, they have to. They can't fool around with it. And as far as horsepower goes, I think the mainstream Corvette will still have over 400 horsepower. But it'll be lighter, so they might not need as much as to deliver the same numbers that they do now.
Quick one. Explorer-based car, or, you know, based on a car platform. Good idea or bad idea?
It's the right idea.
Right idea.
Over Explorer.
The right idea.
Car-based SUV is so passe. They got rid of it, or they got rid of the GM got rid of the Trailblazer for that reason. That mid-sized truck-based SUV is.
And I think the correct way of describing it is body on frame versus unit body. And everybody's got to remember, Jeeps have always been unit body, except for the Wrangler. But Grand Cherokee, Cherokee, all those others, they've always been unit body.
Plus, the new Explorer is striking looking too.
You've seen it.
Yeah.
Brent Adani wants to know, with VW sniffing around Proton, if they buy it, what happens with Lotus? Because Proton owns Lotus, right?
Lotus will have a Volkswagen engine in it. Real quick.
Shouldn't Volkswagen be in Formula One or Audi?
Well, they're considering it. They're also considering IndyCar. You know, there's a... I know our viewers don't like the racing talk, but the basic fundamental thing in IndyCar, the next rule package, is either going to be a V6 twin turbo or it's going to be the global racing engine. And the global racing engine is a four-cylinder of up to 2 liters. And my gut tells me it'll be the V6 twin turbo.
Phil in Burlington says, what happened to the Autoline Daily graphic that you used to play every day? You know, the one with the Ford Flex and the Tata Nano. I really liked it. We loved it too, Phil. We loved that graphic. But we just want to start that show that much faster, and taking out the open just gets you into the news more quickly, even though we reluctantly gave it up. Mark Patterson asks, why doesn't GM just go ahead and sell Opel-branded products in the U.S.?
Oh, GM needs another brand in the U.S. like Texas needs more rattlesnakes. They just got rid of four brands. And
my first car was an Opel. I love Opels. But
did you have a Speedster?
No, probably had a GT, right?
Oh, no, I'm sorry, the GT. Sorry, the Speedster was the two-seater.
I had an Opel Rally Cadet.
Oh, my God. And that's what I learned. Well, the Cadet is what I learned to drive on, but I was like 13
years
old.
And it was the Opel, but it was the Rally, so it was gold with a black hood and black stripes down the side. But, yeah, I did have a GT. We had a GT for a while.
Cool. They were neat little cars, but they just don't need another brand.
Yeah, they don't need another brand. I love Opel.
But another brand where you have a cool car and you say, boy, if we turned the Pontiac G8 into a Buick, it could do a world of good, but it ought to go to Chevy, like we had that discussion.
Just, yeah, it's just not going to happen,
.com.org.
Okay, Ken Davies wants to know, why is the American market so focused so singularly on volume? Because of Detroit's old business practices, or is it just cheaper to build cars than not build them? Or is it because NHTSA makes it so you have to essentially build a separate model for North America, requiring you to spread the cost over high volume? I would just throw out, I don't care how nimble and lithe and just-in-time production and agile you become, volume conquers all. I mean, if you can just make something in higher volume, you are going to have lower cost. It's just that simple.
Initially, it was because they couldn't get rid of the union workers. They went into the jobs bank. They still had to pay them, and they had to generate cash for those massive retiree health care benefits. Now, a lot of that has gone away or been greatly diminished, and they've gotten rid of a lot of the excess capacity, but they still have a big base of factories that need to keep running. And Toyota's in that situation right now. That's why they're discounting cars in the wake of the recalls. They need to keep those lines moving. Everyone has cut out a lot of excess capacity, including Toyota getting rid of NUMMI, but they still need to keep the factories going, so that they're going to focus on volume.
Yeah.
And the big fix, don't forget the big fixed cost base of all these engineers and people working on future powertrains, current cars. There's a big nut of cost in every car company that you got to cover.
Rumblestrip wants to know, what's your take on the Toyota Swagger Wagon TV or ad campaign? Have you seen these?
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned it on the table. I liked it. I mean, people got all exercise with me because I liked it.
I liked it, too.
I mean, come on. It's just, if you can't have fun with this category, and Toyota, in spite of all the stuff that's going on, I applaud them for doing that. It's certainly better than those horrific Dodge minivan spots with the cat people and all that.
I was laughing through the ad.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
It was hilarious.
The performances, the casting, everything about it was just tremendous.
I love when your readers give you a lashing because you simply said you like
them. Well, that's
them.
Like I get up every day and call all kinds of names, but I'm used to it after 11 years.
Phil in Burlington says, as a loyal listener of Autoline Daily and Autoline After Hours, I want you to know that what you say on the show makes a difference. You guys have said over and over again, GM's making some really good products now. I listened, and I'm doing my part. I'm paraphrasing. I'm chopping it down here. My previous cars were from Honda, Toyota, and Ford. As of yesterday, I'm the proud owner of a brand-new 2010 Chevrolet Avalanche.
Well, we were just kidding. We don't really think they have good cars. Sorry.
I thought it was going to be like the vehicle across or something. It's a good old Avalanche.
Rick Stoner says, Peter DeLorenzo must like the new Ford Fiesta. This is big campaign. The videos I've seen are very creative and keep your interest while getting their point across. What say, Peter?
Yeah, I haven't mentioned it on the site yet, but I think they're really, really good. Got the right touch of whimsical feeling going on, and it's perfect for their target market. And I think, you know, they're out front and they're advertising over a lot of people right now.
It's a terrible campaign. I'm just trying to give Peter a hard time.
That's okay.
Salvador G says
I haven't seen it yet, to be honest.
Salvador G says, the oil spill in the Gulf is probably going to last all the way to winter, increasing the price of fuel. Is that in some way a good thing for American manufacturers bringing new products like the Fiesta, the Fiat 500 and such?
I don't think it is. I think they've pretty much got a lid on that, so to speak. I mean, I thought this thing worked today.
I think, John, we need a higher price point for gasoline in this country to get people to sort of, you know, reevaluate, reconsider their purchasing decisions.
Well, two things.
How about get real?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think gas should be $5 a gallon in this country.
Well, I'd say at least let's raise the gas tax and fix the roads and bridges. I mean, that's the very least that we can do.
Because
and I think people, if you said, here's where we're going to pave, here's where we're going to fix the bridges, and here's where your money's going to, I think people would say, well, at least the money's going to something that's going to benefit me.
Yeah, and you're right. We need to get real in this country, flat out. We need to get real.
We're really good at being in denial.
Yeah.
That we are. Pedro wants to know, Peter, when a new model is launched, do you prefer to have plenty in stock so you can sell as many as you can, or would you rather have a smaller selection so you can get way over the MSRP for each model?
Well, it depends on the car company. Now, when Ford launched the Flex, the model mix was too heavily skewed to the loaded Flex, and I think they found out that there was buyer resistance. You know, they had to draw the buyer into the Flex. Whereas if you're like a Porsche or a Mercedes and you have a limited production model, yeah, keep them limited. Make people shell out a lot of money. But that's one of the secrets of this business. And careers have been destroyed on making the wrong call on that.
Absolutely right.
And made.
One of the last things Lutz told me when he was in the last interview I did with him before he retired is he told Mark Royce that GM is for a long time, given what they call the monthly scheduling meeting for production and to some lower-level sales guys, and it was all about volume and just pushing volume out there. And he said, you have to control that meeting and how much you guys produce and get it right. And they've been trying to do that at GM, and that's why you've seen the incentives come down, because they've been trying to get closer supply and demand so they aren't just putting money on the hood to move all the metal or after producing too many or producing too few. And they had some fits and starts with that. Earlier in the year, they ran low on some of the Lambda-based SUVs, the Buick Enclave.
Right.
And they also Equinox and Terrain, I think they ran short on. Even trucks they ran short on a bit because they just didn't get that right, and they're still trying to get there. But
well, I think especially with the Equinox, I think the demand exceeded or surprised them.
It did, but some other vehicles they ran into it too. Some vehicles that I think with full size pickups that would surprise you because they've got the oldest truck on the market. But that's what a car guy does in this business. They figure out.
That's what a good car guy does.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Hey, we got some phone calls starting to line up here. Ben, let's bring in some of these calls.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York, and this question is for David Welch. I was wondering if he thought Opel's latest agreement with its unions will finally put Opel on track to be consistently profitable. From the details I have read thus far, I still do not think the cuts go far enough. In fact, I think Germany's refusal to lend money to GM for restructuring could be a blessing in disguise, since GM would now be freed up to move more of its production operations out of high-cost Germany to lower-cost Eastern Europe. I mean, those German unions actually make the UAW look like angels by comparison. Have a good evening, guys. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
That's a good question. That's some really good analysis. They want to take out 8,300 jobs, reduce capacity by 20%. And, geez, I would never say that the current restructuring at Opel is going to be the answer, because I started covering GM in December of 99 for the magazine, and I remember Mike Burns at the auto show, he was the head of GM Europe at the time, I believe, or maybe it was the year after that, telling me that this restructuring is going to do it, and we're going to make money, or we're going to break even next year, and on we went with billions in losses over the decade. So it's a pretty deep restructuring. The problem is their market share went from, in the first quarter, 9% to 8.5%, which is a pretty steep drop. Volumes are going up because the market is a little bit stronger, but Europe's in tough shape. The German market's in tough shape, and that financial crisis, who knows how
it's just
deep
exacerbating
that's
gonna go. The entire problem in Germany.
So Joe Philippi, who, a longtime auto analyst, when I did a story on GM's earnings, said fixing Opel is like trying to catch a falling knife, because you've got the financial crisis and there's some payback from the really heavy scrappage programs they had. They're making some pretty good cuts. I think they are going to get the money from Germany to do it. Will it be enough? It depends if they can get sales around, because people are pissed off.
I don't think they're going to get the money from Germany.
All right,
and well,
it's
you
less
know,
than $2
billion. GM's got a lot of cash, and I think the Germans are going to say, "Hey,
but I think the money's going to come from General Motors."
That's what I mean.
Yeah,
from GM.
That's right.
I think the Germans are going to say,
"I agree.
GM, you own this problem." Hey, let's get another call in here, Ben.
Hey guys, this is Danny Youngblood calling in Cleveland, Ohio. I wonder if you had a chance to watch the All-Star race in Charlotte. I just wanted to kind of give an observation. Just think how good it could have been if they replaced them, those multicolored shoe boxes that they're running now, and replaced them with Mustangs, Camaros, Challengers, and allow them to use the engines that are available to us right now. It'd bring a whole new perspective to everything. I wonder if any of you guys got Bill Francis' telephone number. Give him a call and tell him to please wake up.
Yeah, that's something.
Have a great night, and next round's on me. All in. Bye.
That's something I've been writing about for
going on
5 years now. So, Mark Rice, for one, is a big believer in, he wants these cars to look production-like. I think Jamie Allison of Ford shares that view, and I think NASCAR is reluctantly listening. Of course, their solution is to put Mustang front clip or on their nationwide cars and calling it good. And that's not going to cut it. I think they need to go to Camaro.
Sounds like a design nightmare.
Yeah, they need to go to Camaro, Mustang, and Challenger with stock dimension bodywork. Go to much more modern drivetrains. That will bring back their hardcore fans who've sort of evacuated the sport because there's nothing there for them. People want, it sounds quaint and corny in this 2010, but people used to go to the track to root for Fords and Chevys and Dodges.
Exactly.
And until NASCAR gets back to that, they're going to be spinning their wheels.
Sure. As a kid coming up, I was always for Ford. I didn't care who was driving them. I was for Ford. And if a driver that I loved went to a Chevy, I hated them. For me, it wasn't about the driver. Hey, Ben, let's bring in another call here.
Hi, this is Charlie from Madison, New Jersey. Love the show. Listen, I got a quick question. I just read that Cadillac is going to start selling its own version of the Lambda platform. Or at least it's coming out soon. And I was just wondering, is this the old GM's brand engineering gone awry again? I mean, they already have three versions of Lambda platform, and why do they need the fourth? And, will this just end up hurting Buick and GMC by having, yet another version of that platform? Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah,
that's a great question. I read that story today, and the same thing popped into my mind is you've got, they got rid of the Saturn version of it when Saturn went away. So now they're the Outlook. Now they're just going to give Cadillac one. I got to think.
I think it's downscaling from the big Escalade, right?
Or is it going to be an addition to the big escalator?
Well, in addition to it, I believe. I got it. If there's any sense at all in the product planning over there, they get rid of either the Buick or the GMC, probably the Buick, because you've already got, you'd still have one of those vehicles at that channel. Right now, you got two of them, except they are very different. I know. The Enclave.
Buick desperately needs that Enclave. And I tell you, this thing stands up to my eye. What is it now? 3 years in the market?
It still looks great.
It's my favorite of the three. The Acadia actually looks good, and it does reach a different kind of buyer. But right. Why would you have four of these things?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. And it's if you do it right, you might be able to make it work. But it's that fine balance edge we've talked about.
I would only do it if they drop the big Escalade. If it replaces the big Escalade, I'd say, okay, it better be good. But if it's an addition, no.
Yeah. Hey, let's keep going, Ben. Bring in another.
Hi, this is Danny Youngblood calling from Cleveland, Ohio. I have a question for Sheila. I think someplace in Michigan there's a new company called Eco Motors. It's funded by Kosala, and it has one of the chairmans is Don Runkle.
Well, he was on the show.
People. They're making a revolutionary opposed piston, opposed cylinder engine that has multi-fuel capacity or capabilities. And I heard I read someplace where one of the first applications might be military. I was just wondering if Sheila has any inside information on that and whether it will be military based for its initial application. Thank you, and set up the next round, bartender. Bye.
It's a great question, but if I told you, I'd have to shoot you. I do think that the military is seriously looking at the technology. That's about what I can say.
But I just read where they just had a huge infusion of capital from China.
I know.
Who did?
And
Eco Motors?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Which is why I think that there may be problems. You know, you have to trace the money everywhere you go in many of these basic research and development concerns, even when they're in our country, because if it's funded by the Chinese, then they get first access to the technology that comes out, and to then use it in a military application removes any competitive advantage it might have given us. And it's a real issue. A lot of people don't understand, just because something's an American company, if the capital behind it is coming from China, it's no longer able to be used for a whole variety of reasons.
Interesting thing. We had Don Runkle on Autoline After Hours.
Yeah, well, when I read that infusion of capital from China, I winced. I was just like, really? That's not a good thing.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see what they're interested in. But Bob Lutz, you know, joined the board of a company called Transonic Combustion, which is coming out with a new fuel injection system. And I noted that Don Runkle is also on that board. And as the caller referenced to Vinod Khosla, I think is how you pronounce his name, guy who's been really big in the high tech and private equity field. So there's some serious money and serious people getting all involved in this, but I had not heard about the Chinese coming in. That's very interesting. Ben, let's bring in another.
Hey, guys. Jonathan Brown in New Jersey. This has to be one of your best shows, one of my favorite guests. Fascinating discussion. As far as the connection between our economy and the military, why isn't the military funding products like Cascada, where we actually can produce ethanol from waste? I think GM was involved with that. Was the military involved with that at all, or should it be? Really a fascinating show. I don't have a lot of questions. I'm just absorbing all the great information and just wanted to touch base and say thank you for having such a wonderful guest on tonight. Have a good night.
Good night, Jonathan.
One of the things that a lot of people also don't understand is that a lot of the decisions that are made by the military are made by Congress. And need I say more? So sometimes you just don't get the right stuff because some congressperson has a vested interest in having something in their org, or their district being funded as opposed to the right person being funded in a different district. And although Congress really does try, they say, to make the acquisition decisions and who gets funded for what, objective process and all that, the politics that underlie those decisions are enormous. And many of those political issues are not really the purview of the military themselves. They have to just deal with whatever Congress hands them, because Congress holds all the cards and all the money.
But I will add this. The military does do a lot of advanced fuels research.
No question.
And what do they call it? Military fuel, JP-8? Very interesting. You know, the military uses one fuel. It doesn't matter if it goes in a Jeep, a tank, a boat, a plane. It's one fuel. And that's something that we could learn from this country, you know, on a commercial scale, because I once asked the EPA how many different blends of gasoline there are in the country, and they said, nobody knows. There's so many different blends from region to region and city to city and season to season that no one really keeps track of at all because it varies so much. And I started looking into this, and I said, what if we took even the most expensive, reformulated for San Francisco kind of gasoline and made that standard across the country? They said you could cut the cost of gasoline like 50 cents a gallon if we just said one, one, and don't worry about the rest.
Well, and it would also level off the seasonal ups and downs that we deal with as well. But one of the things I do have to say is that the U.S. military is seriously looking at alternative fuels, even for the planes. So, and I know the Boeing folks who actually have been flying around using alternative fuels.
Yeah, that project, the biofuel plane.
Yes, and they're doing very well with it. So I think we're about to see a major revolution, at least in the fuels and the way in which the military uses fuel, because it is one of the largest costs at the Pentagon.
Wasn't Richard Branson funding some kind of program for biofuel? It was like made out of hemp or something like that?
Yeah. Probably fits in with Richard, right?
Yes.
But
biofuel made out of hemp, I believe.
Yeah.
From hemp, probably, and it was probably cellulosic ethanol.
He was
contributing.
I think it was.
He was on Bill Maher's show talking about it, saying that if it takes off, maybe they'd have enough left over for the occasional spliff, was his line. That guy, he just lives large. You know, he's this big businessman, makes billions, and he's probably the only businessman in the world who can joke about smoking pot on HBO.
And get away with it. We got a couple of more calls here. Let's get through them. And before we wrap up, Ben, but let's bring in another.
Hi, John. This is Frank from Long Island. I just wanted to mention to you two things. I have two questions, actually. First of all, your show is phenomenal. It's the greatest show on the Internet. I would like to know when they're coming out with the Hyundai Santa Fe, and why doesn't Ford issue a better warranty on their products? Thank you.
Santa Fe's just around the corner, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I can't remember. I want to say it's
end of the summer.
Yeah,
or soon.
Yeah, Chip here is saying September-ish. It should be. And why doesn't Ford offer a better warranty? I guess because they feel they don't have to. Warranties are more of a competitive marketing weapon than anything else. That's how I read it, Peter.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, something occurs to me here. All these callers have this accent. I think we're big in the Northeast.
It's because of you and your roots, man.
Yeah, it's me stomping. It's me stomping ground.
And one more. Let's take one more call here, Ben.
Hi. Could you possibly ask Sheila Ronis, will the U.S. Navy be having magnetic rail guns on at least half of the fleet in approximately a decade or more? I apologize for calling so late in the hour. Once again, my name is Paul Stewart. If you could ask Sheila Ronis if magnetic rail guns will be on at least half the U.S. fleet in 10 years or more.
Did you get that question? Will the Navy use magnetic rail guns in half the fleet within the next 10 years? There's an automotive program for you.
What is it?
Magnetic railguns, just the short thing, is literally shooting bullets at more than supersonic speeds.
Right.
And
fire the laser.
And you don't use gunpowder to do it. It's magnetics that do it.
Right.
Anyway.
I mean, you're asking me for a prediction where all the variables are beyond anyone's control. Do I think it's a possibility? Absolutely. Do I think it's a high probability? Maybe. So I'm sorry that I'm hedging.
That's good enough. That's good enough.
It is.
Actually, there was one point. That guy's Opel question was great, and he said something at the tail end of it. Could, if GM doesn't get the money, could they move to lower-cost countries? That's actually the big problem with the restructuring, is that even if they reduce the capacity, yeah, they're still a high-wage company. And it's great if you sell Audis and BMWs for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, and you can cover German labor rates and everything like that. But when you're selling Opels at the prices they get, it's tough with the labor rates they have. And a lot of the French companies have the same problem, by the way.
Yeah.
But a lot of companies have moved into a lot of their production into Eastern Europe, and it's a problem Opel's going to have if they continue with this kind of old Western European manufacturing base.
Good point. But, hey, we've gone past the top of the hour here. Probably a great time to wrap this up. But, Sheila, great having you on the show. Very interesting discussion.
I do have to say, I do work for a living at Walsh College. So I think it's important for us to state that. And this is part of the research area that I get involved in. So
cool. Good plug for Walsh. I want to mention next week we have John DiCicco coming on. He's a hardcore environmentalist, but a guy who gets it. He understands the needs and reason why we do need heavy industry, but he's a hardcore environmentalist at the same time. That should be a pretty good discussion. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to do a special Autoline After Hours from the Henry Ford, better known probably more popularly as the Henry Ford Museum, but now they officially call it the Henry Ford. And they're starting a racing exhibit there, and we've decided we're going to be part of their gala reception, and we'll be webcasting live from there. I don't know if we're going to get all these people there, but the Wood Brothers are going to be at this event. Roger Penske's going to be at the event. Edsel Ford II is going to be at the event. Jack Roush is going to be there. So it should be a great venue. That's June 10th, and we're going to start early. Instead of 7 o'clock, we're going to start at 6 o'clock to make sure that we've got time to get these people on there.
It's going to be a big deal.
It should be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Remember, you can follow all of us at Facebook, facebook.com/AutolineDetroit, or twitter.com/AutoLine, or always go to autoextremist.com. You can follow Peter on Twitter, twitter.com/AutoExtremist. You can find David's stuff at Bloomberg, BloombergBusinessWeek.com.
Bloomberg.com and BusinessWeek.com.
There you go. He gets it.
And
too.
If you're really hip, you can follow me this weekend at the Alma Highland Festival. I play live. This is going to do for me what Live at Budokan did for Cheap Trick.
You have a website or anything that you want to push?
Yeah, www.walshcollege.edu.
There you go. Thank you all for having tuned in tonight.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.